Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books.
But not as much as we love sex.
Yeah.
Not with each other.
I hoped that could go unspoken.
Well, I just thought of all the jokes we make about the internet living incest, and I was like, true. I feel like this is a necessary comment.
That's right. Unlike in anime, she's really my sister.
Yeah, I'm not secretly in love with him or something creepy. Kind of have my own dude bang back home.
And what a dude he is.
What a spectacular dude he is. Dude bro? He's not a dude bro.
No.
So this week we read The Awakening by Kate Chopin. Which is about a woman awakening to her passions.
Yes. Her asexual awakening.
Yeah.
And a not
self-awareness awakening. Definitely sexuality is part of it, but there are other things happening too.
Yeah. I guess if you're going to write the, two-sentence summary that would go on, like, the little TV guide insert thing, you'd mention the sex, because that'd get people to turn on and watch it. But really, it's more about learning who she is and what she really wants.
Yeah.
All that boring literary stuff.
All that boring stuff women are always doing. Womp womp.
Yeah, come on, ladies.
He gets a shirt.
Come on, ladies, why don't you kill something? Then maybe we'll pay attention.
I think the reason you want to mention sex usually is because I think the sexual content is what so appalled her contemporaries when the book first came out.
You should read that sentence again. Huh? What chapter was that at the end of?
Oh, yeah.
Let me show you how titillating this is.
Here, wait. I'll go grab my copy of the book.
All right.
We'll put the poster.
Okay. Right, and we'll just edit this weird gap out. Now that Gabs is gone, it's time for you to all learn how I really feel about feminism. I was going to tell the audience at home how I actually feel about feminism while you're on.
Oh, Jesus. All right. You ready for all this sexy sex? Good night, she murmured. He did not answer, except to continue to caress her. He did not say goodnight until she had become supple to his gentle, seductive entreaties. That's it.
All right, well, that's we can sex. Finish this podcast, but first I gotta go in the other room and rub one out real quick.
So hot.
You guys.
Your average YA novel contains more sex than that.
That's true. Much more casual sex than that, even. It's not even a big deal in a lot of the books we read.
Yeah, so that's scandalous. We should mention, I mean, the reason we chose the book is because we thought it was about time for a classic and we were looking for something short, since both of us were busy over the holidays, as you can tell, because this is however many days later than it was supposed to be. But Chopin wrote the book in 1899 when Victorian morals still kind of held sway, and the fact that this woman didn't want to be married to her husband anymore and was going around being interested in other guys and abandoning her domestic duties was just thought to be a very big deal.
Yeah, and it even delayed. Did it delay its publishing in general, or did it just delay, like, a more widespread publishing?
A more widespread.
Yeah.
So, in the biography I read, it said that it was published in 1899, she basically earned no money off of it, and it got largely negative reviews, and then it was kind of rediscovered, like, in the 1930s, and really hit a big surge again, like, in the 1960s.
Kind of with the feminist wave.
Yeah, so, I guess the book experienced its own awakening.
You know, work cheesy awakening in every 5 minutes in this podcast.
I also read that it's a common misconception the book was banned, because I was going to mention that, but it actually was never banned. It's just that people didn't like it, and so there were very few copies of it. But if you went to, like, the St. Louis Library, for example, you could have found it.
I see.
It's just there only would have been, like, two copies, and no one actually wanted to go read it because they thought it was...
Right, because all the conservative critics said it was...
Yeah, exactly.
Titillating garbage.
So...
As you could all tell from that excerpt.
Yeah. That was the... Well, maybe not the sauciest moment in the book. Some of the kisses are maybe a little saucier, but... That was the most sexually explicit
thing. But kissing, who cares, right?
Yeah. Who gives a hell about that?
Who gives a hell about
that? Who gives a hell about kissing? All right. So, genre.
I think this is definitely on the shelf under literary fiction, or I guess classic fiction. One of those if you're at a bookstore. And then it's probably what, I guess you could probably call it women's fiction just because it features a woman, and that seems to be the criteria.
And she's discovering herself.
Women will like it because a woman is the protagonist. Yeah,
we already discussed when we talked to the Joy Luck Club how women's fiction is kind of a horrible genre of book and should not exist. It's like, step back, men. Only women care about this.
That's right. That's why I never actually read any of the books with female protagonists.
Yeah, and I should actually also mention that the cover of your copy, Ben, was reminding me of something I saw that was saying the new trend in women's fiction is to show the backs of women or, like, the legs of women, but you don't actually get to see their faces or anything. And the cover of Ben's book is the back of a woman looking out to the ocean.
Looking out. At the surf.
So you can insert yourself into her... I don't really know.
This is something or other. Go ahead.
Okay.
I was trying to find another book cover for contrast, but it was buried under all my shit. There we go. This is my women's fiction.
Okay. Ben's Honor Harrington. It's her face next to a very phallic spaceship.
Yeah, the spaceships in that series are extremely phallic.
Oh, wow, they all are.
Yeah.
They all look like painties.
Yeah, say the inside cover of one of them has all the different ship classes in it, and they're all the exact same penis shape, just a varying length.
Well, I would say then maybe the cover of yours is not too different, because as we all know, women's faces and penises go together. Sexism!
Bam!
Oh, Jesus. Alright, so our plot synopsis for the week. Courtesy of Ben.
Right. Victorian woman learns that sex can be fun.
Yeah. He originally said, remember sex can be fun, but then I said, I don't think she's remembering that.
Gabs reminded me that sex was never fun. It just produces boring children.
Exactly. You're supposed to lie on your back and think of England. Except not in this book, because it doesn't take place in England. But, so yeah, I mean, we kind of already gave you the important gist of it. Essentially, this woman, Edna Pontellier, on this summer stay at this cabin with a bunch of other wealthier families, kind of has this sexual awakening. She falls in love with this guy named Robert and starts realizing these things about herself and her place in society. And when she gets home, she essentially starts rejecting all of the trappings of society. So, you know, rejecting callers and refusing to pay them visits back, not paying too much attention to her kids or thinking they're that interesting. She eventually moves into her own house, and as I read to you those two sentences, she does sleep with another man. So it's really just a book of one woman realizing that she wants to do what she wants to do and saying F you to Victorian values. That's really all you have to know.
Yeah.
It's not set in England, however. Like you might think from that description or just a discussion of Victorian values at all. They did travel over to America, and this book actually takes place in New Orleans, and I think the beach homes are on the Gulf,
I believe. It sounds like they're probably not even that far outside of the city.
Yeah, I mean, New Orleans is practically on the ocean anyway, yeah. So.
There's some beachfront, like, an hour or two outside of New Orleans, I think.
And we don't know exactly when it takes place, but considering it's written and published in 1899, it probably takes place right around 1899. Yeah, it's
a fair guess, right around the turn of the 20th century. The story is told in the third person, I guess kind of centered around Edna, though not necessarily close a lot of the time. It kind of zooms in every once in a while.
Yeah, it's almost like this narrator who's watching her and telling us all, like, what she's doing and some of the things she's feeling, but not, like, giving you all her thoughts, you know, just, oh, she's lounging around and bored or whatever.
Right.
But then, yeah, sometimes it kind of zooms in and gives you her thought process, so we didn't really think it was fair to say it was third person close, because it's not really close the entire novel.
Not in the modern sense of it, at least, yeah.
And there are a couple of scenes without her in them. But not very many.
Yeah.
She's definitely the protagonist of the story.
Yes. And so, let's talk about her, I guess.
Yeah. Good old Edna. So, she comes from Kentucky, a bluegrass Kentucky home. And I guess because I did more than just a cursory glance at the internet this week, I read a 20-page biography on the author. The author did point out that Chopin herself was born in St. Louis to a pretty well-off family, so Edna is not... A lot of people want to, like, say, oh, Kate wrote this about her own marriage and she's Edna, but not necessarily. Because Edna is supposed to be a little more of a hick, I guess, since she comes from Kentucky and a country farm home.
And she finds a couple of things about the city to be just a little bit shocking from a standpoint of, I can't think of the word that's killing me. Just not quite proper, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say proprietary, but that's totally the wrong word.
Yeah.
Propriety, that's the word, maybe.
Proprietus? And so, aside from her eventual separation from society when she starts going, I don't want to do this shit I'm supposed to do, she kind of has maybe a little bit of distance already from the rest of society by not being a city-bred, cultured woman. I mean, she's obviously can, like, play the piano and read and stuff, so she's not, like, country bumpkin girl or anything by any means.
She is marvelously talented in the way that all women are in Jane Austen novels.
Yeah.
One of my...
You all sing and dance?
Say, if nothing else, that reread of Pride and Prejudice was worth it for that conversation, because it is stuck with me quite thoroughly.
And so when we meet Edna at the beginning of the novel, she's kind of bored.
Yeah.
Doesn't really know why.
Since there's so much French in this book, ennui, I think, would be the right term for it.
good word.
Yes, that is a good word. She just doesn't... I don't know, I mean, she's... She doesn't really care about any of the stuff that she's supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Like,
But she's not quite sure why, I think.
Her friend, Madame Ratignolle, is like, oh, I'm gonna go play with my kids and run around with my kids all day. And Edna's like, okay.
She's like, I don't want to watch children being children.
I'm gonna send mine off with the maid and chill here. Stuff like that.
He's, like, hanging out and, I don't know, just with, actually, we got my timeline mixed up a little bit, but she's kind of moving from, like, one thing to the other, it seems like, every 20 minutes. Not in the sense of, like, being super active, but in the sense of, I'm going to sit here and enjoy the air. It's boring. I'm going to read this book. It's boring. I'm going to watch this woman sew. That's boring, too. I guess I'm going to lie here and enjoy the breeze again.
Yeah. I'll draw your portrait. Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
Crumple it up and throw it away.
You get the impression of a restless person, I
think. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think it's fair enough to guess that a lot of women at the time probably would have kind of felt the same way. Like, I don't know why I'm bored by everything.
Right.
I mean, she feels maybe mildly depressed, but not in the sense that, like, she, you know, would be depressed in the modern day, but just more, like, her situation isn't what she wants it to be.
Right.
She's interested in doing other things and fulfilling her own goals, and she can't do that at her current position in society. So that's kind of what makes her restless and bored.
Yeah. And so she kind of starts to... She kind of starts to pull away from that, especially once she goes back to the city.
Yeah.
You were kind of arguing earlier that Mademoiselle Reese's piano performance maybe started the process.
Yeah, I mean, she had already developed her friendship with Robert at that point, and Robert's really the person who inspires her to break free of all this, because, you know, she falls in love with him and wants to leave her husband for something more passionate and pursue this love that she feels, as opposed to just getting married because this guy was interested in her. She thought it was kind of cool. but yeah, when Mademoiselle Reese is playing the piano, she's lying there and just moved to, you know, tears by it, and that kind of seemed to be the first moment where she, like, was struck by the beauty of something and maybe said,
"As one of those moments,
pursue that."
One of those moments of, oh, something made me feel feelings.
Yeah.
That's right, I like that.
That's a good thing.
So, I mean, as this happens, I guess, as this awakening is taking place, she starts to withdraw from polite society, just kind of, like, taking walks and exploring a little bit and, like, dedicating herself to her art and maybe getting a little bit good at it.
Yeah. And I liked, one of the really fancy societal things I liked was that if someone calls on your house and you're not there, they leave you their card with their name and address, and then you have to go call upon them, and you put your cards on this, like, little silver tray that a servant boy carries. Yeah. it's, like, super formalized, and you're supposed to do it in a very specific way. And she's supposed to stay home all day on Tuesday to accept all these visitors who know that, like, Tuesday is her day to accept callers or whatever.
Right.
And she just goes, I don't feel like it. Which, I mean, you don't want to sit in a parlor all day just making small talk with people.
It's understandable.
And she tells her husband, she wasn't there. She just went on a walk. So what did you tell the people who came? I just had the servant tell them that I wasn't here. Like, no excuse, like, medical emergency or something you had to go do? She's like, no.
No.
Just wasn't there.
Just not there.
And he's just so offended. He's like, okay, well, he's looking through the cards. You have to go back to all these high members of society and call on them and then make up this excuse why you weren't there. And she's like, no. I mean, really liked that specific instance of it.
I mean, her husband, I think, really represents kind of what society is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon. In that era. He's the one who wants to observe all the forms and, you know, these are my responsibilities, and as the wife, these are your responsibilities, and
yeah, you're not keeping up the housekeeping or keeping track of the cook, and you should be doing those things.
Yeah.
And he's always working on renovating and making the house look nicer.
Right.
To impress people.
He's concerned with their specific station within the city.
Mm-hmm.
Doing all that stuff. And I guess, for that matter, if we're going to tie him in more thoroughly to what she's feeling, he's kind of the aloof Victorian husband who... I don't know... We don't really see enough to know if he actually feels all that affectionate towards her. I kind of suspect he doesn't really, but he definitely... He has more like this, I think, duty-bound construct of what marriage is.
Wife, right. And this is what I have to do for her.
Right. And, you know, after... So we'll dine together, and then we go to the club and hang out. Until forever.
You're right. Like, I'll go to work for however many hours, probably most of the day. Come home, we'll have dinner, I'll go to the club, I'll come back, maybe after you're already asleep.
Like, right.
They don't really see that much of each other. Although there was instant, toward the beginning, when she was just lying in the hammock, and he came back, and he was like, why aren't you in bed? And I just want to lay on this hammock. And he was really awkward, and he's like, I can't go here alone. He, like, came outside and was, like, smoking cigars and, like, kept trying to convince her to go to bed. It was kind of, like, he was trying to be nice, but, like, in a really awkward way because he just didn't know how to deal with her.
Well, it's almost like a more modern relationship type of moment of, like, oh, well, don't, you know, it's late. Don't you want to come to bed? And, no, I'm feeling weird. I want to stay out on the hammock tonight and just, like, trying to hang out on the porch and keep company, but...
You don't really know what's going on.
Right, it's like, maybe this will blow over. I guess I'll go to bed.
But then, I did think it was interesting when she's like, okay, I'm ready for bed now, and he's like, oh, I'll join you when I'm finished with my cigar.
Right.
So he kind of gets the upper hand, like, I will stay up later than you.
I, like, must reestablish control. desperately grasping for it.
But I think Ben and I were talking about this before we started recording, that we think the most important thing about her husband is that he is very typical of a Victorian man, and that he's not some kind of, like, horrible person. You know, he's not abusive, he's not neglectful, at least by, you know, the standards of the day. He's not mean to her. He cares about her on some level, you know, he's not running around cheating on her. So he's not written as, like, some asshole that she, like, has to escape.
Right, I mean, that's kind of what I was, that's basically what I was saying earlier, right?
Yeah.
If he was a tyrant, that would be one thing, but he's really just kind of aloof. And I do think some modern readers probably think he's a little bit of a jerk just because our concept of marriage is not like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, actually, a thought I just had was that kind of what Edna seems to be looking for is a relationship concept that is a little bit more modern. And, Maybe I should save this for the issues section, but it occurs to me that, like, that kind of ability to have some to have some choice in your relationship and, like, seeking out that passion and sensualness and whatever is part of the reason that marriage doesn't really work very well in a lot of cases anymore, like the divorce rate famously being so high and people liking to say that they're upset with that, but I don't think anyone actually is, or we would change our concept of it. but I think that the institution of marriage, the way it existed in the society of this book, is has kind of not changed enough for the way other parts of society have changed, and that's part of why that happens now. Because if you get tired of your husband or your wife now, you can divorce them and go look for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And then that wouldn't have been the case, but it wouldn't it wouldn't have been the in sickness and in health till death parts us. I mean, that was the vow, but it wouldn't have been that because, oh, I love you. It would have been that because, well, that's just what you do.
That's what marriage is, man. You just gotta stick that shit out.
Yeah.
Till you die.
And I guess I'm not so much running marriage down as I am just kind of looking at the connection between this book, which is, I guess, I guess it'd be kind of pseudo-feminist, even though she, I gather from what I read about her, thought that the women's movements of the day were maybe a little over the top and a little silly. But this idea of women having lots of personal choice and freedom to move around in society was kind of feminist whether she wanted to associate herself with it or not.
Yeah, because it's not so much like, oh, Edna needs to go vote and wear pants and whatever else the women's movements wanted, but more like, hey, she should be able to pursue her own passions and, like, keep her own household and not necessarily, like, have to worry about cleaning all the time. Stuff like that.
It's almost a more modern feminist idea than the suffragettes, right?
Well, yeah, but that's because we have all the stuff thanks to the suffragettes.
Right, I mean, obviously, there were changes that society...
I didn't diss the suffragettes.
I'm not trying to diss the suffragettes. But, I mean, there's obviously a difference between... a society where women are considered are on the books considered to be equal members of society, and a society where women still aren't allowed to have a voice in the process.
So I
get that, but I think that kind of personal choice and freedom
is definitely
that aspect of it it's kind of interesting that it's in there.
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, and there was some comment about ladies' societies that I can't remember the exact phrasing of, somewhere in the book where she basically made a snarky comment about it. The way they were described was...
Was it as bad as Dracula?
Oh.
Some women think that they should do the proposing to men!
No, it wasn't anything like that.
Those wacky kooks! I don't think we can really compare the conception of women in Dracula to the conception
no.
of men.
No, I don't think so.
And actually, I mean, if you take modern feminism to be about choice, which, I mean, a lot of people would argue that that is basically what it's about, then you have these two other examples of women who want other things different than what Edna wants. So you have Mademoiselle Reese, who we mentioned, she's a piano player, and she lives on her own, and definitely wants to live on her own. She's pretty cranky.
Yeah.
Doesn't really like people.
Yeah.
But she's an independent woman who doesn't live with, like, a father or a husband or anything, and doesn't seem like she's ever going to. And then you have Madame Ratignolle, who is Edna's friend, who is definitely, like, the Victorian domestic woman. She has something like 4 or 5 kids, and just loves having children, and
uh-huh.
thinks her children are the best, and adores her husband, and her husband's really sweet to her, and she's definitely the picture of, you know, complete domestic happiness.
Right.
And I guess... I don't know if you could really argue that Madame Ratignolle made that choice because women were pretty much just expected to get married and have kids at that point. But, you know, if she did have that ability, that's what she would have chosen because she's really happy with it. And then you have Mademoiselle Race, on the other hand, who chose, I don't want a husband, and she's completely happy living her solitary existence.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of does the stuff that Edna starts doing all the time,
mm-hmm.
but maybe even to more of an extreme, to the point where people
think she's kind of...
Yeah, like when someone calls on her, I don't know if they are actually expecting anything to happen. They're just like, hey, just I drop by, and she's like, why would you do that? And they're like, all right, see you next week. Like, oh, we're having a party on Friday if you feel like showing up.
She's like, I mean, I guess you can come sit on the couch or whatever, but I'm not going to entertain you. So, that's cool.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, the book just, you know, gives you different examples of women leading different lives.
Yes.
And Edna definitely falls somewhere kind of more in between the two of them, but...
Right. She knows she doesn't want one extreme. And mm-hmm. she probably doesn't want the other one.
She didn't really like having kids that much.
Yeah. And so, I guess let's touch on a couple of the men, other than Mr. Pontellier.
Okay, we should have a Robert for sure.
Yeah, the love that awakened her, I guess, has a tendency, every summer he picks a new married woman to hang out with, devotedly.
Yeah.
And he must be decent company, but... we don't really get a great view of what must be so damn charming about him.
But there is something, because everyone thinks he's great.
Yes.
He's just kind of that typical, like, middling, wealthy, gentlemanly type fellow that people like talking to.
Like that affable oldest son who... I don't know if he's really all that ambitious, but he's not lazy either, so...
Yeah.
There's like, oh, that's Robert. He's great. He's great.
We like him. Well, like, we were talking about how Mr. Pontellier is definitely, you know, the aloof Victorian husband who goes and does his business for most of the day. Robert's kind of the opposite of that, where he is around Edna all the time and hanging off of all of her words and wanting to talk to her and spend all his time with her. Which is maybe, like, one of the appeals to her.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, that's a pretty stark contrast to what she's used to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, a guy who takes a personal interest in everything I say.
Yeah. Wants to hang out with me. Right. Okay, that's cool.
Seems to like me, because I'm me. That's neat. That's a different idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's his main thing. And although he seems to attach himself to various married women, it seems like that she's the first one he actually develops feelings for. Because he eventually runs away to Mexico because he's afraid of being in love with her, essentially.
Right?
It's like, oh, crap.
It's like, oh.
Getting too close.
It's, oh, that trope. Because I don't see that one all the freaking time. We love each other, so we can't be together. What? Stop that.
He's too much of a gentleman.
Stop being so damn tragic, characters in books and movies and TV.
I think that's the main thing, is that, you know, while Edna is breaking free of society, and maybe it's causing a scandal and making her husband angry and all this stuff, she doesn't really care because she's doing what she wants to do. And Robert wants to break free of society and... be with Edna, but he can't quite force himself to. He's bound in by those rules enough that he can't quite push past it.
Yeah. Unlike Alcee Arobin.
Yes. He is... so you have these two kind of gentlemanly guys who have different ways they treat women they love, I guess. But Alcee Arobin, he is the dark man with a bad reputation of seducing ladies.
Right, he's the local ladies' man.
Yeah. He's one of those guys you find in a romance novel who, like, you know, slept with everyone, and then he finds the heroine, and he's like, oh, but now I'm in love for the first time. Except in this book, that doesn't happen. He's just like, oh yeah, more sex.
That's right.
I mean, he does seem to, you know, legitimately be attracted to her, but he's also definitely doing the seductor thing, and I don't think either him or Edna thinks that that they have, like, a loving relationship that's going to last beyond, you know, some physical encounters.
Right.
Because she mentions, you know, even after her night with him, with Arobin, she's still in love with Robert.
Right.
Robert's kind of the chaste Victorian love, and... Arobin's kind of the dangerous,
yeah,
physical love.
So you do get kind of that interesting grouping of men in relationship to Edna, the man she's married to, the man she loves, the man she sleeps with.
Yeah.
Three different people.
Yeah. Just like her female friends are also different.
Right.
Everyone just kind of serves as like a various representation of what's going on in Victorian society.
I think that's fair.
Okay. So, I mean, we've already touched on a pretty good deal of the issues.
Yeah.
I mean, the main one, like we were saying, the feminist spin is Edna's rejection of society. And maybe the most striking to me, just because, you know, you think, oh, you know, she doesn't really want to be married to a guy she doesn't love. Okay, that makes sense. She doesn't really want to do housekeeping. Oh, I'm terrible at cleaning things. I understand. And the one I thought was kind of the most surprising, when she was talking about her kids, the narrator mentioned she's not really a mother person. And it's mentioned several times that she does love her children, but she just doesn't really want to, like, watch them and take care of them. She wants to see them on her own terms and dote on them and, you know, give them what they want.
Right.
But she doesn't want to, you know, be around them all the time and take care of them.
Hey, I get it. I don't think all children are boring all the time, but, like, it's fun to hang out. Fun to hang out with a kid for, I don't know, a bit.
Yeah.
And then after a while, it's like, okay, why don't you go do kid things? Because I am not interested in it.
Yeah. I think the reason I found that surprising is, you know, usually characters in books are just completely devoted to their children, and you're kind of expected to be. So you would think, even if she wants to experience this new awakening inside of her, that she would be like, oh, but I can't leave my beautiful children behind. And instead she's kind of like, yeah, I'll send them off with their grandma.
They'll be okay.
I'm going to talk to them for a month. It's fine. Like, okay. And I mean, I thought that was cool because that's, you know, another aspect of Victorian society that she's rebelling against. And because she basically had to get married and have kids in the first place.
Right.
Like, I think it makes sense that a lot of people probably would have had kids that they didn't care that much about. Yeah, you love them, but you just kind of had to have them, so you know, maybe there's not as strong of a connection as the people who really want to have them.
Right.
Like Madame Ratignolle, who's just in love with her children and adores them and wants to be around them all the time. Like, that's a woman who should be having kids.
Right.
I'm not convinced Edna should have ever had kids in the first place.
Yeah, and I mean, that, I actually thought that was kind of interesting as well, in the sense that that would still be like saying, oh, I love my children, I'm just not that interested in them, would even be a little mildly controversial to this day.
Yeah, even. If you told your friends that about your own kids or something.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that talking about some of this Victorian morality that occurs to me is that a surprising amount of that still lingers at least a few percent. Mm-hmm. Into today's society and how we don't really think about it that much, but I don't know, maybe we should I don't know which book we would have a person like this on to talk about, but maybe we should have someone on who knows about like the history of family and children, especially over the last like couple hundred years, and just how they're viewed. And
yeah,
be an interesting discussion.
Yeah, for sure. Because
definitely families were not kid-centric 200 years ago, and definitely a lot of families now are kid-centric.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but enough of them. I think it's a growing phenomenon, actually. Like, it's kind of a well-known thing, and you hear cranky people. It's one of the things cranky people like to complain about sometimes, actually. I mean, if you've ever worked in a field where you work with kids at all and have to deal with their parents, you've probably met a helicopter parent or two at some point.
According to one of my friend's mothers, who's been teaching for like 20 years or so, she said that parents nowadays are much worse to her than parents 20 years ago were. Because now if she fails a kid, she gets a call like, why'd you fail my kid?
Right.
And 20 years ago, if she failed a kid, they'd be like, why'd your teacher fail you?
Right.
Like, way to fail. Apparently, she had an 18-year-old boy in one of her classes, like, throw a temper tantrum in class because he failed a paper or something. Like, crying, kicking, temper tantrum. It's like, oh, that's bad. That's worse than I've experienced. Yeah. supposedly a thing. But one of the things Edna says about her children that I thought was interesting, she's having a conversation with Madame Rossignol, and she says that she wouldn't give everything for her kids. She's like, you know, I'd throw away my own life. That's not a big deal. But I would never give them all of myself. And her friend doesn't really get that. She's like, well, you give your own life, you'd give all of yourself. But Edna Moore means, you know, she would protect her kids, but they can't have the core of who she is.
Right.
And once she realizes who she is, you know, like, that's the part that she wouldn't give away to anyone. Which I thought was kind of an interesting concept for her to bring up.
Yeah.
And then I just wanted to bring up the pregnancy aspect really quick, because Madame Rossignol is pregnant the entire book and then gives birth at the end. And Edna's there for the birth, even though she doesn't really want to be. and the thing that I was reading was talking about her going about being pregnant in the book, discussing her pregnancy, and then even showing the birth scene would have been pretty racy for Victorian times. Because if you were pregnant, you weren't really supposed to talk about it. You were just having a condition.
Right. I was going to say, contrast that to modern media, where try to come up with one extended family or love story that doesn't involve a birth scene at some point.
Yeah. A television show that lasts longer than four series does not somehow center on a pregnancy at some point.
Right.
Does not happen.
And so I guess also there's a little bit of racial stuff that comes up in this book, less in the form of blatant racism. There are one or two minor examples, but mostly just like the awareness of it.
Yeah.
I keep using all the terms, and the book I had was annotated because I wouldn't have recognized every single one, but like, oh, this, they met this domestic worker who was mulatto, or this one who was a quadroon, or I mean, those are not terms that really even functionally exist anymore.
Yeah, the footnote would say, like, mulatto, that's this mix of people, and quadroon, which is just, like, sounds ridiculously horrible. I've only ever heard it on Archer.
I was going to say that. You get mad when I call you a quadroon.
But, yeah, there's this just awareness of everyone's race. Ben, I think that's maybe more of a product of the fact that the story is set in New Orleans, and New Orleans would have had a lot of different mixes of races, and everyone would have been really highly aware of what everybody was.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought. It wasn't... Because they didn't seem to be noticing it just to create a hierarchy of some sort. They weren't like, okay, the mulatto is ranked higher than the quadroon, who's ranked higher than the... It wasn't something like that. It was just like, no, that's how they... That was just the easiest way to identify that in that time and place, probably. As opposed to the one or two implications that people with African blood in them might be slightly lazier than the rest of us.
Yeah.
Which was a little more blatant, but, like I said, barely... Like an offhand comment once or something like that.
I was going to say that in 1899, you know, all the women of color are the domestic workers and serving.
Right.
And the white women are the ones who are facing these more upper class, you know, difficulties. Because definitely, like, a mulatto servant girl would not really have to worry about the things Edna has to worry about. No. So it's definitely more of a higher class woman's series of crisis and awakening. But that's not really the book being like, oh, the black people are servants because they're bad. It's just that, like, Kate Chopin probably had some domestic servants who were black because, like, that's unfortunately kind of how it worked at the time.
Right.
So, but this book seemed to be much more aware of it than other books we've read that were written around the same time. And I think that had a lot to do with the setting.
Yeah. All right. Move on to our themes.
Awakening! The main theme of the book.
That's right.
How hard can you drive this point home? And as Ben and I have already discussed, I think, enough, I don't know if we've ever said it outright yet, is that, you know, it's about Edna and her awakening, but it's also kind of just a general commentary on, like, hey, maybe Victorian society kind of sucks in the way it operates, and women in general should be allowed to pursue their own interests.
Right.
Yeah, this is the specific story of one woman who follows her own interests, but it does feel a little more all-encompassing than that.
Yeah. I think that covers it.
All the other things I wrote are essentially the same.
So, as far as some kind of points of interest that we haven't brought up yet. Edna had a dinner party right before she moved into her own place, and there's a description of a character that I just enjoyed, which was that of a gentleman who wasn't very bright, but he laughed at everybody's jokes, so everybody liked him.
So they're having him around.
Yeah, and I was just like, oh, like the affable dumb guy. You just don't get those in stories very often. Usually they're an object of scorn.
Yeah, they're around that everyone's like, oh god, he just doesn't get it.
Right.
And in this case, everyone's like, I like this guy.
Well, I think he was a dumb guy that knew his place, so...
Yeah.
He wasn't, like, trying to make the jokes and be the center of attention. He's just like, oh, man, your friends are all so funny.
He's like, I know I don't get this shit, so don't worry about it. The other character we haven't really talked about that I wanted to mention was the doctor. Edna's husband goes to this doctor to say, you know, there's something wrong with my wife and I don't really know what's going on. And the doctor kind of tries to counsel him through it a little bit. And after he leaves, the doctor is like, nah, I actually know what's going on, but he couldn't really say it.
Yeah.
he knows what Edna's going through and has an insight into what she's going to do. And you kind of get the impression he's probably seen this before in other women and that... And he even talks to her toward the end of the book and kind of tries to say, hey, I know what's up.
Yeah.
It's like, it's okay. Other people do this too.
Yeah.
So, okay.
All right, so strengths and weaknesses of the writing. I joked that it was too long and needed editing earlier because it's a really short book.
Yeah, my copy is 138 pages.
Yeah.
It's really not long.
I actually wouldn't mind having just a tiny bit more of it, I think. The only issue I take with it is that I feel like I don't have a complete picture of everything. I mean, I think it does communicate what it is trying to communicate, and we see enough of what Edna is thinking and feeling for it to all make sense. So it's not like that kind of thing. It's more just, I think specifically I just like to see a tiny bit more characterization on the couple of men that she takes an interest in, just so I can understand better why that is.
Yeah, Ben really wants to know why Robert. Why? why does she like him so much?
Yeah. Or for that matter, maybe Aerobean.
Yeah. Like, sexy son of a bitch.
That's right.
It's because he's a foreigner. All women love foreigners.
That must be it.
Yeah, and I just added that, as far as, like, other writing from the time period, it's right on par with that. Well written, but it's not really different from the stuff of its time, so it's, you know, it doesn't really stand out either way. I will say, for younger readers, I did read this for class in high school, and I got through it okay, because I was a good reader, but, I don't think I got quite as much out of it when I was 17 as I did this time around. And I do think if you were a high school reader, just because it is written a little more, well, old-fashioned because it was written 100-plus years ago,
right.
That it could be a little more difficult to read. And some of that stuff that's kind of under the radar, like the sex scene that's like two sentences long, can be super easy to miss.
Yeah, I actually read it. I never had to do this one as assigned reading, but I read it knowing that it is frequently assigned reading. So I was kind of keeping that in the back of my mind while I was reading the book, and I, at the end of that chapter, I definitely paused for a second and went, wow, I never would have caught that as a 17-year-old.
I remember reading this book and at the end of it being like, did she actually sleep with that guy?
Yeah, what's going on?
I wasn't really sure. I didn't know what the big deal was. It's because I missed those two cents. I just didn't get that.
Right.
Fair enough. So, our question for the book, and actually, we didn't really talk about this, is, we talked about how Edna and Robert can't be together because Robert is too hemmed in by his Victorian morals. And so Edna, I guess, decides the best solution is to go back off to the ocean and wade out and drown herself.
Yeah, just to swim out too far to swim back.
And drown in the ocean, that sounds pleasant.
Doesn't it?
So our question is, why does Edna kill herself?
Yeah, I didn't really think she was in the kind of headspace where that would be necessary.
Yeah, if the book's about her discovering herself and her passions, then, I mean, no, she's rejected by this guy she's in love with, but now she knows who she is, wouldn't she?
I mean, it
soldier on?
In a way, it almost negates what's been set up. Like, oh, I'm gonna reject society and find out who I really am, and now that I have to die.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
What is going on?
My theory is that Kate Chopin just wasn't exactly sure how to end it, and so she just took the standard tragedy.
The classic literature.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, I'm not sure what the epilogue should be, so I guess I'll just kill her off. Then I don't have to think about it.
Done.
She knew it was going to be a big hit and was trying to make sure no one could force her to write a sequel.
Exactly. Just like killing off Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, we were saying the sequel of this book would be Robert commits suicide and then Aerobin is some kind of, like, dastardly man for causing two suicides.
Yeah.
And, like, this huge scandal erupts. That would not happen, but yeah. Well, I mean, that might happen, I guess, in the fictional aftermath of Edna doing that.
Right.
But, yeah, I do kind of wish that she had maybe gone, oh, wait, and, like, swum back to shore. Maybe it ends with her, like, saving her life and swimming back to shore. But no.
Yeah.
Dang it, Edna.
And I was also wondering what, because Chopin, Frederick Chopin, the composer, his music features somewhat prominently in this book, and I was going, well, I read enough about Kate Chopin to be pretty positive that if he was a distant cousin or something, it would have been brought up in one of these biographies.
Yeah, like his music is featured prominently in the book because
right.
They were cousins or whatever.
So I think it's just a name shout out. She was like, Chopin!
Yeah, totally. I agree, because I was like, if there was some, like, Roman composer or something,
yeah.
I would totally be like, Roman.
If there's an author, a famous author, last name Roman, then we would have had to have read, like, three of their books.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So I don't even really like these stories. I just feel like I have to.
We have to. So your verdict.
I thought it was okay. I didn't love it. I certainly didn't dislike it. One thing that's true with me is I find it very difficult to dislike short books.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like when we read The Alchemist.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do think it's one of those that has enough food for thought that it's good. It's a pretty good conversation piece. I totally get why it's assigned reading. And so, I mean, I think it kind of in a general note, one of the things that's kind of interesting to me from all this podcasting is that books that are assigned reading, I tend not to hate them now on the reread. and I usually think there's something interesting about them, even if it's not something I would ordinarily read, so.
Something worth talking about, at least.
Yeah. Just thought I'd throw that out there as kind of a personal point of interest, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been discovering the same thing, too, that, you know, for example, I liked this better this time around than when I read it in high school. Although, I think I was one of the people in high school who did defend the book from people who were like, oh, she's dumb, blah. And I was like, oh, God, I'm an idiot. And one of the things I think is interesting about these classics that we read is they have really good things to talk about, but a lot of the times when we finish talking about them, we're like, yeah, those are kind of deep themes that you understand when you're older, and maybe when you're in high school you don't understand them as well, and it's like all of the books that people read in high school.
Right. Well, it's like these books would be, and I guess you assign them in high school because that's when you know you have the students, but like if you could force 30-year-olds to be in like an adult book club,
yeah,
and have to talk about these books,
with a teacher,
they would get so much more out of,
yeah,
them,
yeah,
than they did in high school.
I agree. I think that is interesting.
I guess we could throw that out there. If you're a person who's involved in a book club or something, and you, I think there's an okay chance of that if you're bothering to listen to this.
Yeah.
I think that's actually a good venue for reading some of the classics, and, you know, nothing against like the Oprah Book Club or something like that, because there's some really good,
mm-hmm,
interesting books in a lot of those book club lists that exist, but consider some of the classics for your book club. You might be surprised at how much more interesting they are when you're 15 years removed from this, from the forced slog of a school,
yeah,
assigned reading.
Yeah, if your book club is actually interested in reading and not just like hanging out and talking to each other,
right?
See if you can maybe convince them to pick up a classic or two.
Yeah, for sure. So what are you reading right now?
I'm still reading Under the Dome by Stephen King.
It's like 5 books, so you could do that for like 3 podcasts and not be ashamed, I think.
Yeah, and I'm actually nearing the end. I'm 200 pages from being done.
I would argue that that book reads faster than any other 1,300-page book I've read.
Yeah, it does.
And I say that kind of as a smartass, but also pretty seriously.
Well, today I was thinking, I was like, oh man, I'm like this far from the end and so much still has to happen. I guess not that much has happened. I was like, no, a lot of stuff has happened, but it doesn't... It's very confusing to me.
Yeah.
I don't really know how all this stuff happens, but somehow nothing has happened.
Maybe we'll try to podcast that one in a couple weeks. I'll need 2 or 3 weeks to reread it myself, though. I am reading War of Honor by David Weber, which it should not surprise anybody. Speaking of hefty books, the page count on this one's almost 1,000 damn pages.
Jeez.
I know. So I might be doing that one for another podcast or two myself. Anyway, if you would like to comment or ask a question or send us links to interesting articles about PETA being a Hollywood girlfriend.
Yes.
Read
Rhea's comment,
right,
on our site.
PETA
being a Hollywood girlfriend.
That's right. If you'd like to do anything along those lines, then you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can email us, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
We're on Twitter at novelideaspod,
I've
been neglecting it mildly the last couple weeks, but I know. I run a little hot and cold on Twitter sometimes.
You can also find us on iTunes.
Yes, and if you do rate, review, comment, whatever you can do on iTunes. Send us money. Can you do that on iTunes?
No.
No?
But if we started a PayPal account on our website, people can give us money.
Yeah, they. I don't see why they would, but...
Yeah, I don't know why anyone would give us money. I guess buying our domain name costs like $16 for the year.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you want to donate us $16...
It would be funnier if I opened the PayPal donation button and a person donated a dollar and that just was it forever. That would make me laugh the hardest.
We made $1.
Someone donated a dollar.
And the PayPal processing fees meant we didn't get any of it.
Exactly. We'd probably end up owing them money. For your donation of a dollar, you owe us 6 cents. Oh. Damn it, PayPal. Next week, we are going to be reading Fledgling by Octavia Butler.
She's a renowned science fiction author. She's kind of like Connie Willis in that she's a female science fiction author that's won a bunch of awards, but people don't necessarily know who she is.
Yeah, which is, I mean, even within the, I guess, within, like, the active science fiction community, people who... well, especially write and publish science fiction, but to maybe a slightly lesser degree, people who bother to go to cons and stuff. Like, people who are well-known within those circles and super well-respected within the genre, and for some reason the general public or even people like me, though admittedly I am, my science fiction taste kind of came out of the more classic golden, so-called golden age science fiction, and I've been spiraling into more modern, more yeah, less white dude, I guess, oriented stuff slowly over the course of years. For some reason just doesn't quite trickle out to those circles as quickly for some reason. Mm-hmm. It's too bad, because I enjoyed the hell out of that Connie Willis book we read. So, anyway, I think that's going to do it for this time.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll see you next week.
Bye.